This is Elmer Witt leading off on the second session on the Gospel according to St. Mark, called Mark's Story. And you notice that today the subheading, if you looked at the heading at the bulletin board, is Jesus and Geography, and we'll get back at that. But how many people were not here yesterday? We do have to do introductions, don't we? What I will be doing is simply reading to you from the Gospel of Mark. Part of the session this week is five readings. The translation is by David Rose and Donald Mitchie, who wrote this book, Mark as Story, in which they look at the Gospel of Mark as you would look as at a piece of literature, readily knowing, admitting, and confessing that it's much more than that, but also acknowledging that it is indeed that. And in the process, they have made a translation of it that they think is a fairly good one, and that I happen to agree with, too. And I'm using this one, and the suggestion is, you can bring chairs in from the next room right there if you like. And there's lots of back in the corner over here. The reason I'm using this one translation is to get you all into thinking the same way, because they use the book. They use the words differently. I used the example yesterday when Jesus, the Spirit comes down on Jesus, the verb uses is that the heavens were ripped open and the Spirit came down. The same verb that is used when Jesus dies and the curtain in the temple is ripped apart. So to get those connections. David Rhodes, as I told people yesterday, was here a year or so ago, and I'm a little embarrassed in doing what he does because he has this committed to memory, and I surely don't. So I'll be reading it to you. What David asks when he does it, and I will do the same, do not follow it along in your book. Just sit and listen. The contention is, of course, that's what happened when the story was told. You weren't checking, he's in the fifth chapter now, he's about verse 17. You were simply listening to a story. And the suggestion is that you would just do the same. And this book is in the library, and I believe there's copies in the bookstore as well. If you missed part of it, if they're taping, you can go listen to it, or you can read it yourself, so catch up, because I'll be starting in where I left off yesterday. All right? Get where I can have light as well.
And remember that people are reading your
right. Who and where are they sitting?
Right reading the lips. There. In the front row here.
We checked yesterday, and the bookstore says they're on order to be here in 2 weeks.
Oh, my. I'm very sorry about that. It's a good book. I like the book. I'm sorry that they haven't been ordered previously. Where are the folks sitting? Where I have to? Right here. Okay. That's good. Good reminder. And Jesus again began to teach by the sea. And such a huge crowd gathered about him that he climbed into the boat and put out to the sea. And he was teaching many things in riddles and saying to them as his teaching, "Hear and look. The sower came out to sow. And it happened in the sowing that some fell beside the way, and the birds came and ate it up. Another seed fell on rocky ground, where there wasn't much soil, and immediately it sprouted up because the soil had no depth. When the sun rose up, it was scorched, and because it had no root, it was withered. Other seed fell among the thorns, and the thorns came up and strangled it, and it didn't yield any fruit. Another seed fell on the good soil, and it yielded fruit. Other seed fell where it could be producing 60 and 30 and 100 per measure. And then Jesus said, "Whoever has ears to hear, let him hear." Then later on, when he was by himself, those about him with the 12 were asking him about the riddles. And he said to them, "To you has been given the mystery of the rule of God, but to those outside, everything comes in riddles, so that looking they don't look, looking they look but don't see, and hearing they hear but don't understand. Otherwise they might turn around and be pardoned." And then he said to them, "Don't you know this riddle? How will you learn all the riddles?" The sower sows the word. There are those beside the way where the word is sown, and when they hear, immediately Satan comes and takes away the word which is sown in them. And then there are those sown on the rocky places also, when they hear the word, immediately with joy receive it, yet they don't have root in themselves and are short-lived. When oppression or persecution comes because of the word, immediately they stumble. Others are those sown among the thorns. Those are the ones who have heard the word, and the anxieties of the age and the lure of wealth and desire for other things come in and strangle the word, and it is unfruitful. And there are those where the word is sown on good soil. The ones who hear the word and receive it and produce fruit 30, 60, and 100 per measure. And he said to them, is a lamp brought in to be put under a measuring basket or under the bed? Isn't it to be put on the lampstand? For nothing is hidden except it will be made known. Nor is anything secret but to come into the open. If anyone has ears to hear, let him hear. And he said to them, look at what you hear. By whatever measure you measure it out, it will be measured to you and increased for you. For whoever has, more will be given. And whoever does not have, even what that person has will be taken away. He said the rule of God is like this. A man throws a seed on the ground and then sleeps and rises night and day. And the seed sprouts and lengthens. He doesn't know how. On its own, the earth produces fruit, first a stalk, then a head, and then ripe grain in the head. And when the fruit delivers up its yield, immediately sends out the sickle because the harvest stands ready. He said, how shall we compare the rule of God? Or into what riddle shall we put it? Well, it's like a grain of mustard seed, which when is sown on the ground is the smallest of all the seeds in the earth. And when it is grown, it comes up and becomes the largest of all the bushes and makes such great branches that the birds of heaven are able to rest in its shade. And with many, many such riddles, he was telling them the word as they were able to hear it. Now he was not talking to them without a riddle, but privately for his own disciples he would unravel everything. And he said to them on that day when evening came, let's go over to the other side. And leaving the crowd, they took him along as he was in the boat, and other boats were with them. And a fierce squall of a great wind came up, and the waves were dashing up into the boat, and so that it was already, the boat was filling with water. And Jesus was in the stern on a boat cushion, sleeping. And they roused him and said to him, teacher, don't you care that we're being destroyed? And waking up, he rebuked the wind. And he said to the sea, be quiet, shut up. And the wind quit. And there was a great calm. And he said to them, why are you cowards? Don't you have any faith yet? And they were frightened with great fear and were saying to each other, so who is this that even the wind and the sea obey him? They came to the other side of the sea, to the district of the Gerasenes, and as Jesus was getting out of the boat, immediately he was met from the graves by a man who with an unclean spirit had been dwelling among the graves. And no one was able to bind him any longer, not even with a chain, because he had been bound often with shackles and chains, but the chains had been shattered by him and the shackles smashed, and no one was strong enough to overpower him. Throughout every night and day, among the graves and in the mountains, he would scream and slash himself with stones. And seeing Jesus from a distance, he ran and gave him obeisance, and screaming in a loud voice, he said, what do you have against me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I'm putting you on oath by God not to torment me. But Jesus had kept saying to him, unclean spirit, come out of that man. And Jesus asked him, what's your name? And he said, my name is Legion, because we are many. And he pleaded with him wildly not to send them out of the district. Now they were at the side of the mountain, a large herd of pigs. They were feeding, and the unclean spirits pleaded with him, saying, "Send us to the pigs so we might enter them." And Jesus let them do it. And coming out, the unclean spirits entered into the pigs, and the herd, about 2,000, rushed down the bank into the sea and drowned in the sea. And then those who had been feeding the pigs fled and reported it to the city and in the fields. And people came to see what it is that had happened. They came to Jesus and they observed the demoniac, the one who had been the legion, sitting dressed and sane. And they were frightened. And those who saw it recounted for them how it had happened to the demoniac and about the pigs. And the people began to plead with Jesus to go off from their territory. And as Jesus was climbing back into the boat, the demoniac began pleading with him that he might be with him. And Jesus did not let him, but instead said to him, "Go off to your house and to your family and report to them what the Lord has done for you and how he showed you mercy." But he went away and began to proclaim in the 10 cities what Jesus had done for him, and everyone was amazed. When Jesus had crossed over in the boat back to the other side, a huge crowd gathered about him again, and he was out by the sea. And one of the synagogue rulers came, Jairus by name. And seeing Jesus, he fell at his feet and pleaded with him urgently, saying, "My little daughter is almost dead. Come lay hands on her so she might be restored and live." And Jesus went off with him, and a huge crowd was following him and pressing him. And there was a woman who had a flow of blood over the course of 12 years and had suffered greatly under many doctors and spent everything that she had and had not been helped, and rather was getting worse. And hearing about Jesus, she came to the crowd from behind him and touched his cloak, for she had been saying, "If I just touch his clothes, I'll be restored." And immediately, the source of her bleeding withered up, and she knew in her body that she had been cured of the ailment. And Jesus immediately, aware in himself of the power that had gone out from him, turned around the crowd and said, "Who touched my clothes?" And the disciples said to him, "You're looking at a crowd pressing against you, and you say, 'Who touched me?'" And Jesus kept looking around to see the one who had done this. Now the woman, frightened and trembling, having realized what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has restored you. Go off in peace and be free from your ailment." While he was still talking, people came from the home of the synagogue leader saying, "Your daughter died. Why bother the teacher anymore?" But Jesus, overhearing the word, said to the synagogue ruler, "Don't be afraid, only have faith." And he did not let anyone at all follow along with him except Peter and James and John, the brother of James. And they came to the house of the synagogue ruler, and Jesus observed a disturbance, sobbing and loud wailing. Entering in, he said to them, "Why are you making a disturbance and sobbing? The little child didn't die, but is sleeping." And the people jeered him. But driving everyone out, he took along the father of the little child with the mother and those with him, and went in to where the little child was. And grasping the hand of the little child, he said to her, "Talitha kumi," which is translated, "Little girl, I'm telling you, rise." And immediately the little girl rose and began walking, for she was 12 years old. And they were stunned immediately with great astonishment. And he ordered them strictly to let no one know about this, and then told them to give her something to eat. He came out from there and went to his hometown. And his disciples followed him. And when Sabbath came, he began to teach in the synagogue. And many who heard him were astonished, saying, "Where did this one get these things? And what is the wisdom given to this one that even the works of power such as these come about through his hands? Isn't this the carpenter, Mary's son, and a brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon? And aren't his sisters here among us? And he is a stumbling block to them. Jesus said to them, a prophet doesn't lack honor except in his hometown and among his relatives and in his own house. And he was not able there to do even one work of power, except that laying his hands on a few frail people, he healed them. And he was amazed at their lack of faith. He began going around to the surrounding villages teaching, and he summoned the 12 and began to send them out two by two, and was giving them authority over the unclean spirits. And he was giving them orders to take nothing on the way except a walking stick, no bread, no beggar's bag, no coins in the belt, but to strap on sandals and not wear two tunics. And he said to them, wherever you enter into a house, stay there until you come out of that locale, and whatever place doesn't receive you or hear you, go out from there and shake off the dust from your feet as testimony against them. Going out, they proclaimed that people should repent. And they were driving out many demons and anointing with oil many frail people and healing them. And King Herod heard, for Jesus' name was becoming known, and people were saying, John the Baptizer has been raised from the dead, and that's why the works of power are working in him. Others were saying, he's Elijah. And others were saying, he's a prophet like one of the prophets. But when Herod heard, he said, the one I beheaded, John, has been raised. For Herod himself had sent out and seized John and bound him in prison on account of Herodias, the wife of Philip, his brother, because Herod married her, and for John had been saying to Herod, it is not legal for you to have the wife of your brother. Now Herodias was holding a grudge against John and wanted to put him to death, but she wasn't able to, for Herod was afraid of John, knowing him to be a just and holy man, and was protecting him. And when he heard John, he was quite puzzled, but he was glad to hear him. And an opportune day came when Herod, on his birthday, held a banquet for his greatest men and his military leaders and the most important people of Galilee. When Herodias' own daughter entered and danced, she pleased Herod and those reclining to eat with him. And the king said to the little girl, ask whatever you want, and I'll give it to you. And he swore an oath to her, whatever you ask of me, I'll give it to you up to half of my kingdom. And she went out and said to her mother, what should I ask for? And her mother said, the head of John the Baptizer. And immediately entering with haste before the king, she asked, saying, I want you right now to give me on a plate the head of John the Baptizer. And the king became profoundly sad, because he, in his oaths and those reclining to eat with him, he did not want to refuse her. So sending for an executioner, the king ordered him to bring John's head. And going off, he beheaded him in the prison and brought his head on a plate, and then gave it to the little girl, and the little girl gave it to her mother. And when his disciples had heard, they came and took his corpse and put it in the grave. Those sent out gathered around Jesus and reported to him all they had done and taught. And he said to them, you yourselves come privately to a desert place and rest a little while. For many were coming and going, and they were not even having an opportunity to eat. And they went off in the boat to a desert place. Would you be willing to take about 2 minutes now and just talk to someone next to you about some of your reactions to hearing this section? Just anything that came to mind, or that, just for 2 minutes, would you please?
Yeah, I was struck by the way he makes the daughter of Herodias a little girl.
Mm-hmm.
And that almost really intensifies the tragic irony almost that a little girl has to ask her mother what she should be given if she turned out to be the death of John the Baptist. Mm-hmm. But he repeats that kind of thing two or three times. It's little girl, right?
Yeah.
That's different from my image of.
Yeah.
But also it says a 12-year-old was a little girl.
Mm-hmm.
And you have different images of little girls, but a little girl could be 14 and quite a sensuous person.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
What I saw in those two stories was that in both situations it was a child and a parent, and the relationship and how it was so different between the stories.
Yeah.
The first story, the child had such care and concern for the ill child, the dead child.
Mm-hmm.
The next one is manipulation of a parent with the child. The contrast of those two relationships.
Mm-hmm. When we talk about the characters on Thursday in the book, it's in the book, and that's what I'm going to get to on Thursday. It's interesting that the small parts, sort of the walk-on parts, are very important in the Gospel of Mark. And sometimes the walk-on parts are the ones that symbolize what Jesus was hoping like mad would happen with the disciples. They don't make it, and the walk-on parts do. Sort of a good reminder. Yes?
I have Andy sent him to the desert for renewal. And coming here from San Francisco area, we went through the high desert, but this area here is far away from a desert setting, as if you're thinking that we're here for this renewal.
Mm-hmm. Sure. A desert. I happen to be a desert rat. I lived 6 years in the high desert of California. I love it. And I think it is a place of great renewal. And just it happened to be some different colors around. And I got to be interested in rocks and everything else. And in the renewal in spring. But you know, I think both places. But Jesus was close to desert places. Sure. And then went up in mountains once in a while, too. Now, I read something by Wolfen Bergstrand this morning. Said, Jesus was a desert, I was a mountain. So, Wilton, he'll be here in about 3 weeks teaching. Somebody else?
Well, one reaction, hearing the story read orally like that, really sucks you into it and draws you into the power of Jesus and what was happening. Mm-hmm. And the way Jesus had power over the wind and the spirits and illness, his total authority.
There's an exception to his story, to his authority in the gospel. Yeah, maybe we mentioned this yesterday, I don't know. Are you aware of it?
Mm-hmm.
Al?
Yeah, it was when he went to his own town and he was not able to.
Right,
do powerful works.
And that's a better exception than I was thinking of. The one I was thinking of is more generalized. He doesn't force any humans to do anything. If the wind's out of line, zap. You need food, zap, whatever it may be. But he doesn't force humans. His power is not totally, in that sense, over human. He does not control in the sense, you aren't a believer, I'm going to make you a believer. The people in the town don't believe, he can't do it. So there is Jesus is empowering of humans, but he does not zap them like he does, you know, shut up or demons go here or whatever it may be. So there's some built into the story limit of his power.
The tragedy of having to save face. I mean, Herod kills John to save face.
Yeah.
I mean, and not such an ambiguous passage, but just to look good still and not back down, he kills his whole person.
Yeah, by implication, it was a sexy dance. We don't, we make some. That may be as much of the American culture making that adjustment. It might also be true. And again, his quote excitement gets him into a bind when he goes bonkers by promising up to half of the kingdom. That's pretty good pay for even contemporary standards for a dance.
Hearing a longer section read, for me, I felt I was getting caught up into a growing conflict or an escalating conflict between good and evil, between the power and rule of God and Jesus, and an evil, darker power and rule that finally, with the beheading of John, hit its height. Evil. You get the sense it's going to get worse.
That's right. There's
more to come.
Yeah. In the book, again, they make a large point of that, is that it just keeps growing. And it's about in chapter 8 where it makes the turn and starts moving down towards Jerusalem when the plot has been clearly established. And Jesus catches on himself in this story that he must go die, and begins telling the disciples then as they turn from the north and head towards Jerusalem. And it's clear from that point on in Jesus' mind, and because the omniscient storyteller tells us what's in Jesus' mind, then we are clued too that now the time has come for the plot to reach its climax. As we pointed out yesterday, some people say that really the Gospel of Mark is the passion story, which is the last couple of chapters of the book, with a terribly long introduction, just getting you ready for that part, and that's the plot. The third chapter in their book deals with the plot. We'll be talking about that tomorrow too. But you're feeling just exactly what they say is happening. Right. Yes.
Well, listening to it, I thought that you could really see it come alive and visualize what was going on. And I thought one of the scenes really showed both the humanity and the divinity of Jesus when he's on the boat, and they wake him up out of a sound sleep, and he's like sort of like you're a little out of sorts when you wake up in a situation like that. So you know, it's tell the wind to shut up and stop, and then has a few slightly cross words for the disciples, yeah. Not having faith, having to wake him up out of a sound sleep. And
you could have handled this one. Yeah. Yes.
I like the image of the 20,000 pigs running into the sea. That must have been quite a sight.
You can understand why the people wanted them to leave.
I was very moved by the woman who was hemorrhaging, because the way I thought about the story before, when Jesus said, "Your faith has saved you," and it was almost like in that she knew what she was doing. But listening to it here, she was so terrified when Jesus said, "Who did this?" It was as if she had, like a child, sneaked up, taken something that wasn't hers. This was her perspective. Yeah. I thought, oh, she must think that if she fesses up, that more ill than she was before, all those ramifications, but she does anyway. And then Jesus says, no, that was yours. You know, instead of, you didn't do something wrong, but that was yours to have taken, it's everyone else's too, the gift of life.
The double expression of faith, the touch and then the confessing of it, and then both took a whale of a amount of faith.
I want to say something about the pigs too.
Sure.
It's very interesting to see what other churches or other cultures do with that story, because mm-hmm. there is a church in Zaire, the Kimbangas Church, mm-hmm. which is a Christian church, but it's an African church, obviously, and they do not eat pork because mm-hmm. of that story. Mm-hmm. Because the evil spirit went into those pigs mm-hmm. and drove them over the cliff. Mm-hmm. To this day, they don't eat pork.
Mm-hmm. Do the Jewish people eat pork? They don't do it.
No.
Now,
this was
their story. Yeah.
The possibility that storm on the lake it's very common in that area for storms to come up very suddenly mm-hmm. and then to suddenly cease.
Yeah.
And so the possibility is that when Jesus turned to them and say, "Be still, don't worry," he wasn't speaking to the storm, but telling the mm-hmm. disciples, "This is not anything to worry about. Mm-hmm. Be calm, have faith."
Mm-hmm.
And so it could be mm-hmm. for them.
Could well be, sure. Christians tend to like Jesus pushing around the creation.
Is it Mark, though, that has the comment that even the wind and sea obey him?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. That's the disciples' reaction. They say, "Who is this?" Because even the winds and sea obey him. Their perception was. The narrator doesn't say it.
No. But their perception is, though, that he is controlling
right.
the wind.
That's right.
We both enjoyed having you telling the story and standing
over here and watching the signing at the same time, because it was like this wonderful dramatic story that then was sort of being acted out for. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's really neat. Yeah.
I was impressed with the reading and together with the signing, so much so that in the story of the woman, I could feel the tears coming to my eyes as she realized she was found out. And the same with the raising of the child. If you have had the helpless feeling of dealing with parents who have lost a child, and you wished for that power, mm-hmm. and wouldn't know what to do with it if you had it, mm-hmm. And then to just be a part of that story, and I guess in the telling of it, I was there, mm-hmm. and the same way with the scene of John, it would be hard for me to imagine a little girl being handed a platter with somebody's head on it and accepting that. It would have to be, well, I don't know what kind of upbringing she would have to be exposed to that kind of thing and still be able to carry that off.
She took it immediately.
It must have indicated.
I can imagine how fast she
of course, the word immediately is a Markan word. It comes in almost every other paragraph. And it's just his style, the story's teller's style, of keeping the thing moving. So it may not reflect her fear, but it could on the other hand too. But it's immediately something happened, and immediately something else happened, and immediately that's the recurring thing in all of Mark. Yes.
I read a couple of weeks ago an editorial on the storytelling of Garrison Keillor.
Yes.
And the remark was made that Keillor is a gifted storyteller because he tells you just enough so that you can follow what happens and you can understand, mm-hmm. but he doesn't give you a lot of description, mm-hmm. so that you fill all that in immediately with your own mind, which makes the story much more vivid than he would tell you detail.
Sure.
And that struck me because that gospel do the same thing. They're very sparse, really, when it comes to giving a lot of detail, and yet when you get drawn in, and reading does that, I mean, listening does that more than reading it, I think. Mm-hmm. You just visualize and fill in the scene much more than is actually mm-hmm. there, which is, according to that editorial, mm-hmm. The genius of telling a story, particularly one that's going to be orally shared.
I got a connection with Garrison just yesterday. I don't know if this is true, but I'm willing to tell it. I got this powder milk biscuit one, which Phil Brunell sent me. Phil was on the last show and said, this is what you get when you appear on the show. And he asked him for an extra one and sent it to me. So I'm sort of proud of having a copy of the powder milk biscuit thing to work. We hope to, Garrison will be back in the States, and he's going to have an office in New York in fall. We hope to try to get him to come out. Phil Brunell is still working on a songbook with him too that's coming out pretty soon. But Garrison, you know, is current just about the best teller. All right. Somebody else.
I'm struck by just the mystery and question of evil. Mm-hmm. That it's the evil spirits that know who Jesus is and confess that he is the Holy One of God. We even pick up their language in our liturgy and sing those phrases of the evil spirits in mm-hmm. our liturgy. And I'm intrigued at the dialogue that Jesus has with them and the evil spirits wanting to stay in this district, mm-hmm. like the senior seminarian. I don't know what that means. I'm just really intrigued with that. Yeah. And Jesus almost honoring their integrity.
Yes.
And dialoguing with.
Sure. Yes.
But along those same lines, sometimes when the evil spirits said, almost like a prayer, we want to stay here, please send us into the pigs, and Jesus did, and then the pigs went over and they were gone. And it makes me think sometimes about our prayers that are self-centered or evil, and it made me think, be careful what you pray for because you might get it the same way.
You might go over the edge. Good. Thank you. Yes?
It struck me that Jesus was telling the man who had evil spirits driven out that he was to become an evangelist, to go out to others. And yet it also struck me that after the healing of the child, that Jesus did not, he said, don't tell anyone. And I was curious about it.
Yeah. That's a repeated phrase in this first section of the Gospel. First 8 chapters, at least, Jesus says a number of times to people, don't tell about it. He's the only person that Jesus says no to when they want to follow, too, that we know about, anyway. But he does send them on a mission, which is, you know, go tell your family that, which he, according to the Gospel, he really doesn't do. He goes across the way to the 10 cities and spreads the word there. But there is this repeated phrase of don't tell anybody about what happened. Mixed in with some phrases where go tell your family about it, you know, in this particular case. No, are there any other reactions to that? Yeah.
To me, this had so many things happening in the short period of the book. And when you hear a sermon or anything, you'll just hear one portion of that, and you never realize that so much of this had happened all this within a very actually short period of the history in the Bible.
Or at least as Mark puts it together.
Right.
He very much wants to create that image. That's that immediately business. He just compacts it and zoom it goes. So it's sort of pushing at us. That was the feeling. That's why some of those stories inserted that you were saying that slow us down and make us look at the little child or something are in there too. And then I think, as I said yesterday, the Mitchie and Rhodes point out that the story now, when it gets to that 8th chapter, begins to center down and to slow down. And there's less of this rush business as the closer and closer he gets to the crucifixion. So there is a conscious storytelling technique that says, now we're getting to the heart of this, we will slow the pace as we do it.
It's interesting, as you mentioned, that Jesus has different commands for different people about how best to follow him. Like when the rich man said, how do I be in the kingdom of God? And Jesus said, give everything you have to the poor and follow me. Mm-hmm. And then this other man that wants to follow him, Jesus says, no, this is what you're to do. Mm-hmm. And other people, he says, go and sin no more. And some people, he says, come. And
sure.
It's very different, so it's not the same message, the same command for everybody.
Yeah.
When I was listening to Jesus telling the disciples what to take with them, you know, no beggar's bowl, and only one tunic, I mean, not even two tunics, and I was thinking of our morning meditation, you know, the extreme contrast that we have now. I mean, I doubt there's a person in this room that came up to hold them with just one tunic. You know, and to imagine to be going off on a big long trip, and you know, just taking nothing.
We have a good Holden story about a young fellow who's here and only had one t-shirt the whole time he was here and was working on our cat. And of course his t-shirt got caught and one of the things got ripped to shreds. So here he was without any t-shirt. The community, you know, got all together and gave him his t-shirt back. But there, every once in a while, there are people here who have only a pair of jeans and a couple pieces of underwear and a t-shirt. So some of those people are around yet.
Well, this fellow's over here.
They left all their tunics home. That's great. That's neat. Well, now we'll have to start selling tunics in the store. One at a time. Good line. Please.
I think Jesus' point there was not materialism and poverty, even though, but freedom of movement. In other words, the disciples were to be totally free to and to go wherever they were led to go, and they were not in any way to be hindered by the encumbrance of having a lot of stuff along. So the point there is not poverty, but freedom.
Well, What do you think?
Well, I would just like to say, which points out to us that all of our material things do often weigh us down and keep us from being free.
Like, don't have to worry about insurance if you haven't got much to insure. Yeah.
I hadn't thought about today, but a lot of the times when Jesus was telling people, be still and not tell anybody, it was something that they were all excited about and happy for. And with this guy where he says, stay here and tell people what great things God did for you, I wonder how it was when the guy that ruined the economic base of this town?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm the guy.
I don't know what to do with that yet.
And yet, he was the guy screaming, cutting himself with stones and doing all the other stuff, and now he's saying, they're going to have to live with seeing this guy. So, okay. We'll see.
Well, I think, too, that Jesus uses the man when he asked him to stay in his hometown as a living reminder to the people there. Because I'm sure what it was, after dark, don't go anywhere near this guy. Because one weirdo rolling around. So here he is. He's saying he's walking among people. He's living with his family. He's going into towns that were afraid of him all these years. And so, Jesus had a very special mission for him. Because here was a man that was obviously healed. Mm-hmm. Because he was obviously crazy. Mm-hmm. And so by using that, and I think, too, it's the gifts that we have. Some people have a gift of missionaries and the gift of evangelism. Mm-hmm. And some people have the gift of staying home and ministering to their congregation. Mm-hmm. It's one of my personal feelings is that we do a lot of emphasis on evangelizing to the young church, and there is not a movement to keep feeding the people that are already Christians. I find myself sometimes with a lack of spiritual food because the ministry is, you need to have both. You have to have people to focus in your congregation on the congregation, and you have to have people in the congregation to focus outside the congregation. Mm-hmm. You have to work with each other. But when you focus totally within your own congregation, you stagnate. When you totally focus outside your congregation, they come in and they leave. Because they're not having something that's going to keep them there. And so Jesus is taking care of both.
Sure. And to be aware that God's activity isn't localized either in a congregation or just where we send missionaries, but that the whole world, the scope of it, this forest and those skies that Bill flies through in a big plane up there, all of those are part of that kingdom. I keep telling the story, when I grew up in a little, my gosh, it was 2,500 communicants and 12 parochial school teachers. But that was quite clear. Our pastor believed that the kingdom of God was in St. John's congregation, not in any other Lutheran congregation, but just in this one. And God's activity is surely in those places, but in all of it as well. And that, I think, comes through with the relationship also to the settings here. It's really, the Gospel of Mark is a story of a trip. It's a journey. And just telling what happens on the trip, all the incidental things. And in Jesus and geography, he just, en route, there's all kinds of these local settings, like the river, the desert, the sea, the mountains, the houses, the boats, the synagogues, the temple. All the places are there. And again, if you go back and read this, I think, interesting translation, it's only 27 pages, you can do about 40 minutes. If you read through and look at the places where Jesus was, and you get to be able to pick up some of the overtones, and again, that the storyteller was reaching back into the history and life of the people listening to it and hooking things and bringing them in. Mountains were pretty important stuff. Rivers were very important in the life of the people. And the houses, there was the intimacy of these places as well as the crowds that we saw. So it's part of the whole story is also the choice of the places where all of it takes place, and Mitchie and Rhodes do a very good job of pointing that out to us. I always get suspicious sometimes, and I have to be corrected, I know, because the implication is that the people who heard it the first time picked up all those nuances. And I always say, well, how come today when we do things, nobody gets a nuance? I don't get a nuance. But everybody back then always got nuance. How come they were so bright and we are so dumb? I don't know. Now, somebody said in the first session, well, maybe they really did. Maybe they spent more time in scriptures in those stories than we do. You know, we got all the other stuff, all the things to absorb, and the information age even more. We fill ourselves with stacks of other things, so maybe we'll miss a mess of nuances. So maybe there was more of a focus on it. But I was a suspicion that there might be somebody like me living back then that missed a lot of those nuances. But anyway, from our point of view, we can see some of the connections that may also have been pretty obvious to those people as this story was told. I think that's an interesting aspect of the of taking a look at the gospel. That's why it's fun maybe to concentrate for a week. In addition to hearing the gospels read here, I encourage people to pick up one. We've got a dozen translations lying around here in the library and other places, or maybe you brought your favorite along. Just sit and read the thing yourself. It's not the same, but you might be more into it if you're hearing it read too during a week. And sort of be nice to go home and say, you know what I did last week? I read the Gospel of Mark 3 times. Yeah. Nobody will believe you, but you know. It'd be fun to report. Somebody else? Any reaction?
I just finished reading Paradise Regained by Milton.
Mm-hmm.
And in there, he says that the legion has to be put into the pigs because legion didn't want to go back to hell. All those spirits wanted, you know, it was bad enough where they were, but they didn't want to go back home.
Didn't they? First session, somebody said something similar. They said it was like the Screwtape letters. You messed up, so now you get a lousy assignment.
Yeah.
Your next assignment. But they didn't want to be done away with. They wanted a little less good assignment. Yeah, that's interesting.
It's interesting that anybody that's the devil or that connection doesn't like water.
Yeah.
Which water on
me. Oh, yeah.
It's always a connection.
Okay. That's a good scientist perspective thing.
Yes. It's going to be clams.
Yeah.
I was listening to a tape by somebody that's into the charismatic movement and exorcism.
Mm-hmm.
And he's saying that he was dealing with I think it was a girl that named off 16 evil spirits that she had.
Yeah.
And he said, okay, your spirits come out of her. And she freaked out. And he said, you had to go back and take them one by one. And taking a training course in counseling, where the leader was saying the same thing, don't try to handle, you know, all these different problems. You know, to deal with one by one, or you're going to be in bad trouble. Mm-hmm. And here Jesus comes, and the guy says, 1,000 of us, boy, and beat it. Yeah, it's just really impressive.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You know what happens if you don't pay your exorcist on time? You get repossessed.
Well, Canadian humor isn't all bad.
Must be an American.
Yeah, you have to wait for Americans that are a little slower at catching on. Anybody else? Any response?
Well, now that you've stopped, I can add mine. One of the things while signing that, the pace, when we were talking about all the riddles, Jesus was asking all these different riddles to the people and explaining how, you know, you may hear this and not understand it, or you may hear it and understand the hidden, it's not hidden, mm-hmm. you know. And the pace was very fast. And then as the story progressed today and the clarity became manifest, you know, then it slowed down. And so it was, the riddles, you know, was being very clear to us. So I found that the writing style of that was very intertwined with how they it became unraveled, I think was the word that they used.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting.
That's a nice verb. Unraveled. You can get unraveled, but the things can get unraveled for you too. How do you like the word riddle for the parables and all that?
I have trouble with it.
Okay.
There is, I guess, always a riddle dimension to it, but it seems like a parable also contains the essence of a thing and says it. And it may be a story or it may not be a story, but sometimes it's a story, which doesn't strike me as a riddle, and yet the riddle dimension of it's there because you have to figure it out. I did stumble over it.
Yeah, okay.
Whatever happened to an earthly story with a heavenly meaning?
Yeah. That's such a nice story. Yeah, I remember that.
But the nice thing about the word riddle, well, in this context, parable, we're so used to that word that it's a story with a meaning, and we know the meaning because we've heard it over and over and over again. And riddle makes us think that's something that we have to solve. And from the disciples' perspective, they didn't understand what was going on, so it was a riddle. But I hadn't thought about it that before.
When I think of a riddle, it's always a question and an answer. I think that's a good approach to a parable. What's the question and what's the answer? But I agree with you. The parables seem to have more of a depth. The word parable. A riddle, that's not math jokes. My kids tell me. But I like the question and answer part of a riddle.
But they didn't have the answer part. That's why I like the riddle, because they didn't know what the answer was. What are you talking about?
But Jesus is our answer. It's that kind of question answer. He is the answer to these riddles. No,
but the disciples in this story don't have that. That's right.
That's for us as the readers to still figure out the rhythm. That's what keeps it alive. The story is just something that happened and you hear it again, but the riddle is still alive for us.
Yeah.
We're still answering.
Yeah. Well, the phrase riddle of life, you know, gets it out of the knock-knock category.
There's a tremendous sense of mystery about the whole thing, the whole story, and Jesus' presence and who he is. And striking that he explains the purpose of his riddles is to confound almost further. And the whole thing is confusing to me still about why Jesus would want to confuse people.
Well, I get, I was sitting up there when David Rhodes did his first session on this, and I don't think I told it there yesterday. He said, you know, what's your reaction? And nobody would say anything yet. And I said, well, so far, Jesus comes off as a smart bottom guy. He was parrying this, and you ask a question, he asks a question back, and he tells these people to keep quiet, he tells those people to talk, and all that thing. And, you know, you really could get an understanding that there would be people that didn't like this whole bit. And Rhodes' response was, you're getting close to the kingdom of God, you know. The annoyance of the story. And we always say, well, we better add a little gospel here, meaning sometimes to placate people and get people to feel good again. And it may well be that adding a little gospel is a way to really irritate about.
Let me recognize that one of the things that stood out to me anew was how astonished the people were. And I always thought of that as impressed, and they must have really loved Jesus for seeing these things, but I got a new sense about that word as kind of fearful and
distancing.
Yeah,
almost.
Scared.
Yeah, Larry?
I was struck a little bit how dumb this Baldur, who tells a simple story about seeds, and it's so obvious what the answers are that any sixth grader understands, and still has to explain it.
Yeah. Disciples come off tough in Mark. Yeah, they do. We'll do it when we talk about the characters. And the Rhodes and Ritchie think they maybe got a bum deal. So we'll talk about that on Thursday. They were a whale of a lot of expected with them, in as far as the story is concerned, in a very short period of time. Right. Anyone else? Sure.
On that riddle business, Chris Kendall of the New Testament Prophet Harvard.
Indeed.
One time,
We tried to get him to come here this week.
Really?
Yes. Go ahead.
He said that it's exciting teaching college students who are not brought up in the church religion because they're fresh and open, and the Bible is provocative and a riddle to them, which they're drawn into it. He said the trouble with teaching kids who've been brought up in the church is that they know the answer to the riddle before they hear the parable.
Yeah, that's right.
And he says they are not really drawn into the parable because they know the answer before they hear it.
Sure.
And, it's sort of like that, I think. For someone in the church, the parallel seems to be the striking thing. But for someone who's new to the message, it's the riddle factor, I think, that is most provocative. Mm-hmm. It leads one to wonder, what is that about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I should agree with Krister. Yes?
Feedback on that. I mean, teacher in storytelling, so never explain a story. Explaining a story always kills it. I guess it relates.
Yeah, it's a story about the little girl with the balloon that I tell every once in a while. And, you know, and everybody wants an answer to that story. And I, having learned that, I've never given an answer to that story. Really annoying kind of a story. But
in Sunday school, sermons.
Oh, yeah, we're always explaining.
Letting it explain stories, you know. Yeah. Really. Yeah. Going to light with. Yeah.
And trusting the people, you know, here's this is what concerns me about all of the Bible study we do. You know, Dan Erlander comes and teaches Bible here, and it's just great because he's fabulous. But he does an awful lot of explaining of things too. Well, he's a storyteller, but he does that too, and because he knows so much. And sometimes Dan and I just fight about this because, you know, it sounds like, Dan, unless people have done as much studying as you, they're not going to get what's in this story or in this book. And there is a sense in which we really have to believe that people hearing this story for the first time or any time can figure things out without the benefit of the scholarship stuff. And no, I'm pro-scholarship. I mean, who wants Krister Stendahl unless you really want to hear something more than you've heard before? So it's a struggle back and forth for me on that, too. Because I truly believe that people can hear and understand with the power of the Spirit, but I also know that people can get mixed up about it. But most heresies started with clergy.
You're collecting the herd of heresy.
I've got me. No, no. No, he's too kind. Who would start with something like me?
Well, but Dan takes, you know, people have been Lutherans for 20 years, and he
cuts
away the Sunday school and the confirmation, and he goes back and he re-explains it to them.
Yeah, amen.
You know, he gives them the details that they need to...
Yeah, and as John Tram says, he's one of the guys who can get in under your radar. For sure. Thanks very much.